All right, welcome back. Thank you guys so much for joining us today. And here we go. Another of my favorite, this is my favorite part of the show. And I've got a special guest today. And it's one that I don't understand why we haven't had on in the past. We've tried a couple times. There were some scheduling things. But a guy that I've wanted to have on the show for a long time, and it happens to be a guy that I work with. And so that's new. But anyway, without further ado, I want to introduce you guys to Marcos Bueno, who is the portfolio manager for our algorithmic portfolio. Marcos, it's been a long time coming, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Zach, I am so happy that we get this done, and it is an honor and a pleasure to be on your show.
It's been a long time coming, huh?
It has been. I mean, it's been, I think the first time we talked about this was a year ago.
Yes, yes. And I'm not, like I said, I really don't have a good reason for why we haven't done it sooner. But anyway,
it's my fault. I'm a shy guy.
So. That's right. Okay, so let's now. Marcos is joining us right now from London. He's an international man of mystery. People, this is a guy. He's from Spain, by way, then came to New York. But anyway, before I start talking about your background, why don't you tell me how you got here? Why you and I are talking? Your background, where you grew up, how you got in the business. Just give us, you know, give us the bullet points and run us down to how you got to the point where you're managing, really, you're managing about half of our assets for us right now and doing an incredible job, by the way. But how did that happen? How'd you get here? What's your story? And how are we talking to you today?
Yeah. So as you said, I was born and I grew up in Spain until I was my early 20s. That was a long time ago, and I still haven't gotten rid of my accent, as you can tell. So I've given up on that. So basically, I grew up there. I got an engineering degree back in Spain, but I wanted to do other things. Spain was a bit small for me. So I moved to France to study, where I got 2 degrees in... I got a master in engineering, a master in applied mathematics and economics. And after that, I started doing management consulting a little bit all over Europe. But my dream always was going back, was going to America. So I got accepted at an MBA at a Wharton school in Philadelphia. I was there. I did well. I graduated close to the top of my class, and I joined Goldman Sachs in London. So it happened to be right after 9/11, in the middle of the recession. There was no place for me in New York at the time, but there was a place for me in London. So I moved to London to work for Goldman, and I was a little bit of a whiz kid in derivatives. So I was a exotic and hybrid derivative expert, and I was devising investment products for Goldman clients. But that was, my heart was not in it, to be honest. So my heart was on the managing money, on the making investments. And back in the day, I was a believer on the value school of investment. So I joined UBS to manage some of UBS capital with a value strategy in commodities and equities. So I was investing in oil companies, in oil futures, copper companies, copper futures, gold miners, anything that had to do with commodities and the commodity producers and consumers, power, utilities, things like that. Very old school, a lot of research, very little trading. It will take 3 months to research an idea, traveling around, visiting mines and oil fields and companies, and it was quite an interesting experience. I learned a lot, and in the world of commodities, it's very global, it's very macro, and I discovered that I liked the macro world, where you have a much bigger picture of investments. You think about countries, you think about currencies, you think about flows, and it's sort of like liked it. And pursuing that world, I had an opportunity to go to JP Morgan to manage some of the JP Morgan's capital in their prop desk. So I was a prop trader for JP Morgan for a few years. Did well. I learned to trade currencies, trade other things, fixed income, and I became a macro trader. And that ultimately led to a partner position at a global macro fund called Graham Capital in London. So we opened the office in London. By that time, I'd been in London for 7 years, even though I wanted to be only just two. So, but it happens that you find a job, then you change job, then you meet a girl, then you marry the girl, then you have kids and stuff, and one thing leads to another. And
well, and that's the curveball, right? You said I met a girl. Yes. I mean, that's how these things happen. That's how you end up in London 7 years as opposed to two, right?
Yeah, I ended up actually. It ended up being 10.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I met a girl.
10. Yeah. Yeah, but at some point, I said, well, I want to change my life. I want to go back to America, which is what I always wanted to be. I think America is the best country in the world. All things considered, it's just the best and still the best. So I wanted to be there. I think I wanted my children to grow up in America. So my wife wanted the same thing. We decided to just quit our jobs, sell our house, sell everything, pack up, and go to America. I'm lucky that I'm married to an exceptional woman who, thanks to her, we got a green card on the first day going to America. We got sort of like the VIP treatment of immigrants because she's a very accomplished woman.
And by the way, she's probably the best financial mind out of the three of us.
Without a doubt. Yeah. Without a doubt. Yeah. No, she's a world-class expert in interest rates.
Yeah.
So that got us to America. And to give you just an anecdote, we go to JFK with our three kids, among them a newborn, our 12th packet of 12 suitcases, and we didn't have it. It was a spectacle. So we get to the border control and open the passports and stuff, and we see that we have sort of like this VIP visa because we like, and the officer says, oh, hold on 1 second. And they take us to a separate room and say, welcome to America. This is your details. This is going to be your green card. And we're so happy to have you here. And it was sort of like a surreal experience of sort of like having the red carpet. It was awesome.
Well, that's the advantage of being an international financial man of mystery. You see, I don't get that treatment.
You're already American.
That's true.
Anyway, we're in the process of getting the passport because we really like the country and we want to be Americans.
Well, and we're going to get you back here at some point.
Yes, I that's the plan.
Yes.
Anyway, so in America, in New York, we were in New York, we decided to do something different, more entrepreneurial. I took all the learnings from my career and her career. We tried to launch a big hedge fund. We worked on that for some time, and we were very close, but ultimately failed. It was a shame. We had a great team and a great opportunity, but we couldn't get it off the ground in the end. So we moved on, and I started managing my own capital. I decided that I had clear ideas of how I wanted to manage money without the constraints of your investors and a very specific mandate. And I also learned some things about the markets, that they don't work the way I thought they work. They don't work the way they taught me in school. They don't work the way they're supposed to work. It's just, it's a shame that it took me like 15 years to learn that. I should have, but the reality that it did take me that long to understand that the things that move the market is not what we think it is. It's not what we hear in the news. It's not what we hear from the companies. It's not what we read in financial statements. What moves the market is supply and demand, like any market, and the prices are set by the relative strength of supply and demand. And when there is a lot of demand for something, the prices go up, and when there is not a lot of demand for something, the prices go down. And from that simple idea, my whole perspective on the market changed. And it's actually something that happens a lot in commodities, and it happens in currencies. The ultimate price is set by how much demand and how much supply. Real estate is the same thing. Any market is the same thing. And that was sort of like an epiphany for me in terms of stock market. It's not EV to EBITDA. It's not profits. It's not price to earnings ratio. It's not. It's just how much people like something. And that changed completely my perspective. And when I was managing my own money, I decided to put this to work in a systematic way. I use my quantitative background, my engineering background, combined with my experience trading and managing capital from all sort of like derivatives, value, macro, systematic trend following, and I created the algo that that we're using today. And the algo is a very simple idea at the origin. It's just we buy stocks that are going up. And it sounds dumb, but it is what it does.
Look, in your self-deprecating manner, which I appreciate, but it there's a lot more to it than that. And I know that because I would say that I have a slightly better than novice handle on financial markets and investing. And spending a day with you in your offices in New York and going through the math in so many of the ways, I got to tell you, it's not very often that my eyes roll back in my head and I get lost. But that happens to me talking to you on a regular basis. So it is much more elaborate than that. And one of the things that we talk about that I think it's something that you and I really, really hit it off on was risk management. There are a lot of momentum funds out there, and that is what the underlying characteristic is, right? It's a momentum fund. Find the things that are working. But yours had a distinctly different aspect to it. It was a momentum fund with a very rigorous risk management structure underneath it, which is really what got my dander up. Why don't you explain to the listeners how you, because those are two things that don't typically fit, right? Are you a momentum trader? Are you a value trader? What is it? And on the momentum side, there's not often a lot of talk about the risk management aspect. Kind of tell us how that was born and then how you the genesis of the risk management strategy that underlies that. Because for people that don't know, during the downswing, and when you get violent pullbacks in markets, it's typically the names, and you guys can go through a lot of the names on your own screens. It's typically the names that have run the hottest and the highest that get pounded the hardest. You get a big downdraft, like 36% down on the S&P in a 5 to 6 week period. And, you know, you, as a momentum player, you expect to get pounded. And before you answer that, I'll just tell a little anecdotal story. There was a morning during the middle of that downswing when markets were getting obliterated, and I came in and the Dow was down 10% pretty much right out of the gates. And I pulled up the momentum portfolio that you manage, and I sort of had my one eye closed, one eye open, like kind of cringing to see what the outcome would be. And the Dow was down 10% and your momentum algorithm was up 0.2 on the day. Which I hit refresh a couple times. I don't know if I've told you the story from my side of the desk here, but I hit refresh a couple times because I was like, wait a second, something's got to be off here. And so the whole story was you had this momentum portfolio that just killed it last year. We go through this period of time when the market was down 36%, you were down 7%. And you're positive on the year. How did you integrate such a rigorous risk management approach into a momentum algorithm? Those things don't typically go together.
That's true. They typically do not go together. Because even though the algorithm is based on very simple and fundamental principles. There are basic principles that are very easy to understand by anybody, even those that do not manage money. The implementation is far from trivial. So the principles basically are buy the things that are going up and don't buy the things that are going down. and it's very simple. It's like, now, how do we really implement those ideas, right? How do we implement this idea that it's of no use to buy things that are going down, that the most important thing that we need to take care of is not losing money? So when it comes to it, we basically divide all the stocks in the
Marcos, hold on one second. Sure. Hold, and I should have interrupted you in that space, but I want the listeners hear me speak about this all the time. Now they're listening to a guy who's been a prop trader and managed money at Goldman Sachs, UBS, JP Morgan. And they hear it from me all the time, but this is one of the things, like I said, that you and I had a meeting of the minds on, and it was really a thing in common. And you said we don't want to lose money. How important is the we think about investing in terms of picking the right stock, finding the thing that's going up. Obviously, that matters. The thing that most people do not understand, right, is the easiest way to improve your long-term returns is to not take a big, nasty loss. Do you see that as, you know, priority number one, or is it priority number two? Kind of explain how important that risk management process is, or that risk management feature is, in relation to the long returns. Because again, clients think about it as finding the right stock. They don't think about it in terms of preventing catastrophic loss is also a really easy way to, maybe not easy in the implementation, but an easy way to improve your long-term returns. So explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so in terms of priorities, it's number one and number two, and everything else comes later. If we do not have capital, we cannot make money.
Right.
If we lose 50% of our money, we need to make 100% just to break even.
Right.
Losing money makes our job of making money extremely hard. It's much easier to make money with money than without.
Yeah.
It is simple, right? But it's so true. Now, people forget about this. The most important thing is to not lose money. The most important thing is not to know what to buy and when to buy it. The most important thing is to know when to sell it.
Yes.
And that is extremely hard. All the literature, all the books, all the shows, all the TV programs, they will talk to you about the ideas. They will talk to you about what to buy and when to buy it. They will never tell you when to sell and how to sell, because that is harder. That is actually the trick.
And it's not sexy. It's right. It's not the thing that sells, puts the tails in the seats. It's not the thing that sells. Tell me the idea that's going to make me rich. I don't want to hear about risk management, right?
Yes, it is. It is the reality of it is that you get more eyeballs, you get more clicks, you get more a bigger audience when you talk about what to buy that will make you rich, because that is sexy. But what is the truth is that when to sell and not lose money is more important. Like when we were down 7%, we only had to be up like 7-8% to break even. When the market was down 35%, that means they had to go up like 50%
right,
to break even. So you make a mistake that loses you 35%. You have to find another idea that makes 50%. That is very hard. So the key is when we buy something, we have a very tight risk management in the amount that we are willing to lose. And the moment the stock that we buy stops going up, it becomes a slacker, it starts to go sideways, it starts to go down, we automatically sell it. And we take a lot of small losses, but we never take a big loss. What this means is that when we buy something and it doubles, we are going to go with it and double the money. But if it goes down, let's say 5, 6, 7, 8, 10%, we are out. What this means is that even if we had a 50-50 hit ratio, when we make money, we made 50%, we made 60%, we made 70%. When we lose money, we lose 5%, we lose 7%, we lose 10%. That means that on balance, we have a positive expectation of making money because we cut it short. The moment we lose money, we sell it. And we lose a little bit. And it's a little bit like managing people and managing employees. And sometimes I make this comparison. Is that I hire my stocks as they were employees. And if they work hard and they work for me and they earn their spot, I keep them. And if they become slackers and they don't do their job, I fire them. This is what we do with stocks.
Yeah, no, okay, but it's even more complex than that, and it's more rigorous than that, because I've seen this work in real time, but I've also watched there's a human hand involved. You're the one implementing the trades, but when to buy and when to sell, the algo is determining that, correct?
Yes, so I am explaining the principles, which are simple.
Okay, yeah.
Which are easy to understand, but the implementation is a lot harder. And it took me actually a few years to figure it out. Because in the same way that we can say, my employee is not working, I should get rid of him or her, it's a lot harder to actually do it because then you have to find somebody else. You want to give it another day. You want to give it another chance. And when it comes to stocks, it's like, how do we really define what a stock is going up? It's really easy to see it on a screen. It's much harder to tell a computer what it is. To tell a computer what it is in a timely manner, we can look at a stock and say, okay, this stock went up in the last year. That's easy. What we're trying to figure out is that when is a stock entering a new regime that will make it go higher? That is a little bit trickier to define. Defining when is the moment to sell, what is a room that is acceptable to give a stock to fluctuate, because all stock fluctuate. We should not be distracted by the noise. What is that? How do we tell the computer that? That is a little bit trickier. How do we build the portfolio so we have a risk control at the portfolio level, not just the position level? That is also tricky. So this is something that is hard to implement, even though the principles underlying it are very, very simple. And why people don't do this is because it is hard to implement from a technical perspective, but it's also difficult to implement from a cognitive perspective. We as humans, we have a number of cognitive biases that work against us in the markets. They work for us in nature, in everyday life. It works against us in the market. Because what we believe is the right thing to do in regular life is actually the wrong thing to do in markets. To be persistent, to be strong in the face of adversity, to be different, is something that is valued in real life. It's something that can be very expensive in the market. To be emotional in the market can be difficult. And we all have those biases, and that's why the markets sometimes become irrational, because of the cognitive biases of the people that are involved in the market. So that's why overcoming those biases that are inside all of us is actually very difficult. So there's the two aspects that why this is difficult to do, even though in principle it's actually quite simple. But I would say that the risk management, as you say, is sort of like the key to our performance, because we really never lose a lot of money. And that puts us in a very good position to take the opportunities that come our way, they come on regularly, and we take them. And when we take an opportunity that makes us money, it makes us a multiple of what we lose when we lose a little bit of money. And ultimately, that's the key. It's a portfolio of stocks that are going up. And the moment they stop going up, we fire them. They get out of the portfolio, and we always have stocks that are doing well. And sometimes it happens that the market goes down as a whole and we don't find stocks that are going up. We don't find good opportunities. And our philosophy in that case is just to sit on the sidelines. We just wait until the storm passes. Like when you are driving in the highway and it's sunny and there is good visibility, you go for it. That's what we do. When we see a lot of opportunity and the coast is clear, we go for it. But when you're driving in a snowstorm, in a blizzard, and you don't see anything, you go slowly. We do the same. When the market conditions are not favorable, when we see a lot of risk and not a lot of opportunity, we're going to sit in cash waiting for better weather. And that's what we did in March. That's what we did last summer when we had the sell-off. In March, to give you an idea, we went from fully invested to 95% in cash in a matter of 3 weeks.
And yeah, we sat it fast.
Out. It happened really fast. And we sat the storm when it was there. It was nasty. But we were just sitting peacefully. And the day that you mentioned when the market was down 10% and you were up is because we were sitting just in cash and we were invested in a few stocks that were benefiting from the coronavirus.
Right.
We found the stocks that were benefiting from the circumstances that were making the market go down.
That was an odd experience for me, because I will be honest, it was a bit intimidating. There was one day, and I tell the story with one day, perhaps it was over two, but in the middle of that storm, on that day in particular, where I was telling you that we were up, there was a lot of cash, but I believe it was two stocks on the same day were up more than 80%. And I remember just sitting there scratching my head going, I have had stocks up 80% before in a day. I have never had two.
we had that day when we bought a stock and the next day was sort of like up 80%.
Yeah. Yeah. What did the algorithm find? How did it pick a stock that in the middle of a market meltdown? And there were two of them. And I don't know if they were on the same day, but it had to be the same week. Two of them were up over 80%. How did it find those?
That's the secret sauce, Zach.
See, I thought maybe if I had you on the radio, you'd actually tell me. I know, but we do have to keep the secret sauce. The whole point is it's not a market timing mechanism. It is looking at stocks that are working and it's blowing out the ones that aren't, right? There's not a market timing aspect to it.
There is not. It is a pure, it is very granular. It's looking for stocks that are benefiting from whatever situation we are in. And that are delivering. So going a little bit deeper into it, basically, we all have a drive to do better. That's another concept that is underlying this algorithm. We all have a drive to do better for ourselves, to do better for our families, our communities. And entrepreneurs, they also have visions. They want to get rich. And they launch companies, and some of these entrepreneurs are really good. And some of them are benefiting from a certain moment in time where they get to benefit from a change in society, change in taste, demographic trends. And what this means is that when you put this all together, we have stocks that trend up for a long time because it's driven by some sort of like basic human behavior. And when you have a guy like, let's say, Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, where they create something exceptional and they're extremely good operators, they create companies that become very big. But at the beginning, they were small. And in the process of going from small to big, we end up with uptrends in the market.
Yep.
Companies that are in the right place at the right moment with the right people in them, and they create super winners. And those stocks, they tend to trend up. So what we do is we find those stocks and then we get on the trend and we ride the trend as far as we can. So what happened in March and what happens normally is that in any given set of circumstances, there is always somebody that is doing well. During periods of economic growth, a lot of people are doing well, so we have a lot of opportunities. But even in periods of recession, periods of uncertainty, there is always some people that are doing well, that whatever it is happening is benefiting them. And as a result, those stocks will do well, and we will get into those stocks. So we don't take a view on the market as a whole. We just look at stock by stock, and there's probably like 5,000 stocks we look on a daily basis, and we end up selecting 15, 20, 25 of those 5,000. So it's very, very selective. It's very, very strict. The bar is set very high, but the quality is very high of what we find, because we have a long list of criteria that we need to meet to deploy capital. Another part of the risk management is being very selective. I'd rather sit in cash than take a risk that is not worth it. Protecting the capital is always the number one priority, and that means being very selective when investing. So basically, for out of these 5,000 stocks, we select just like 15, 20. Right now we have 23. And it's always looking for those guys that are doing well, whatever the setup. And we always find some. Sometimes we find one or two, sometimes we find 25. And in that case, in March, when things were selling off, there was this company that is doing Teladoc, that is doing healthcare remote, like video conference for healthcare. And I forgot the name of the other one. Was a vaccine manufacturer that had an announcement, and then the next day went up 80%. So there is always those things. There's always those guys that are doing well, no matter how badly other people are doing. There's always somebody doing well, and we find them.
Yeah, no, and I can attest to you, it's changed the way that that we do business. It's changed the way that we manage and you and I working together, quite honestly, it's even changed the way that I look at things managing our value portfolio. We focus on value, but I've become much more attuned to what you do and your philosophy, and not only do you and the algorithm manage half of our clients' investable assets on average, but it's also had its impact, because a lot of the things that you say, you know, you do this job long enough and you see things, and you and I have talked about this a lot offline, but where you play the game the way you're supposed to, and exactly what you think is going to happen does, and you're proven right on your thesis, and that the investment performance doesn't come alongside, right? And those can be very frustrating, very trying times. And it doesn't mean, at least for our firm, that we want to throw that out completely. But what it does mean is that it sure helps to have what you guys do and have that approach as part of like I said, on average, half of our exposure on the equity side, because the same thing when our approach isn't working, or if it's out of style, it's really cushioning that blow to the overall portfolio, and it's allowing our value portfolio. We feel very fortunate because we missed a lot of the downturn. But I don't know what the numbers are of as today, but I we're right at break even on the year, and in terms of the market, and you guys are positive, so it's helped offset that. It's also brought a different style into investing, and I think that another thing that you and I have both agreed on is that this craziness in markets due to what governments are doing to what central banks are doing. I don't think that this is a storm that we're going through. I think this is much more close to a new normal. And I think that in the future, as it has been in the past, certainly the last 12 years, and you could make an argument the last 20, but volatility is becoming a much more constant companion, if you will, in the markets. And I don't see any sign of that abating anytime soon. And I think that risk management is going to become something that a much larger percentage of even retail investors are conscious of. I think it will become something that is talked about, even on the retail side of it. Do you agree with that? And if so, it's always been important. And you did a wonderful job of laying out, you know, if we lose less, we don't need to make as much. It's really that simple. But do you see structural changes in the market? Do you agree with that, that intervention of central banks and governments have made things even more unpredictable, therefore really highlighting the need for part of the portfolio to have the kind of approach that you're laying out?
I do agree. And if I can make a little bit of a comment there. I think there are two ways of managing money in the stock market. One is what we do, and one is the old school value approach, in which you buy companies that the market is mispricing. And having a 50-50 approach there, I think, is very wise. And there are studies, actually, that show that a philosophy like ours, which is momentum, and a philosophy like traditional value approach are negatively correlated. They both have a positive return over the long run, but they have negative correlation. What it means is that when one is doing well, let's put it this, when one is not doing well, the other one is.
Yeah.
What it means at a portfolio level, you end up with a very stable set of returns where you're making money on a constant basis, but basically regularly, but your risk is much smaller. So you're like a plane with two engines, right?
Yeah.
So if one fails, you still have the other one.
Well, we've seen that. I mean, and it's funny, right? Because you and I both knew that going into this, but watching it play out over the last 5 months, we've discussed this extensively. It has been amazing watching how that has played out. For instance, in the bounce back phase, you know, between the end of March and really the beginning of June, the momentum portfolio was much hotter. Our portfolio with more of the value approach, it came back some, but it really didn't participate in a lot of that bounce back. Now, we were down much lower than most were, so we didn't have as much ground to gain. Now, the momentum portfolio has been kind of a constant performer. It really hasn't, at least with my experience at this point, we haven't had a bad stretch. Even when a lot of the high-flying tech names and some of the momentum names were getting killed, it still hung in there. But we've seen this back and forth action. It really outperformed at the beginning of the year and in that bounce back. And then it's kind of quieted down over the last month, and the value portfolio's taken off. We've watched this happen in real time. And I got to tell you, it has me kicking myself that we didn't do something like this sooner, because it has been a very good marriage, and we've seen that play out.
Yeah, no, and as I said, there are studies that show it. And to some extent, there is a similar idea. You were talking about the risk management, how important the risk management is, and not losing money. And if you go back to Warren Buffett, he says rule number one is not lose money. It's the same idea, but the value approach, they think about risk in a slightly different way. The risk management is a low price. If I buy something that is worth a dollar for 25 cents, the maximum I can lose is 25 cents, and I can still make 75 cents up to a dollar, and then maybe more, right? So it's the same thing from the other end. But there is a very, very risk management orientation in value approach, and that also why it works, because when they lose a little, and when they make a ton.
Yeah.
What is sort of like difficult is in the middle, where you can lose a ton and make a little. That's not work. That's not great.
Yeah.
So we do it one way, and value approach does it the other way. But the underlying principle is the same. And when one thing is working, the other one is in a pause, and they alternate. But together, it works.
Well, and like I said to you, And I don't need to tell you, you know, because we've had many a long phone call, especially so far this year. And you know, staying true to what we do on the value side, because I think, again, I know both you and I agree that having both approaches is important, but also learning a lot from you and learning how to incorporate some of those same principles and how we manage the value portfolio. And it's been a tough one to get my head around, but the efficacy has really proven itself out, and the results, I think, speak for themselves. And it has been an incredible winner. Now, if we could, now I could sit here and see, we're talking our own books here, literally, right?
Yeah, literally,
literally talking our own books. So if we could, I want to pivot a little bit more, because you have sure. a really, one of the reasons you came up with this algorithm, and one of the things that I think that you and I hit it off with was, you know, I tend to look at markets differently. You certainly do. What are we looking at right now? Is you know, start globally talking about the markets right now, because I, as a value guy, and again, you know this, we've talked about it extensively, it's been a very trying time because valuations are completely separated from underlying fundamentals, and I think that's pretty much a market wide. There's always some exceptions, but that is pretty widespread at this point. How long can something like this go on? Is it completely random? Is it completely undeterminable? Is it or unable to be determined? Or is this? Do you think that this could last for a significantly long period of time? And is it the new normal?
The short answer is yes. Now that's when I'm going to put my macro hat on.
Earlier, when you made the comment about wanting to get into the macro side, I almost interrupted you and said, "Boy, that was a bad decision." Right?
That was bad. I mean,
that's I'm a macro junkie too, and sometimes it feels like an abusive relationship.
Yeah,
right? So, you love it, but it constantly hurts you.
I don't think so. I think it helps, to be honest. I think it helps. But I love macro because I love geopolitics. I love politics. I love market as a whole. I don't necessarily always want like looking into the nitty-gritty detail of a company. I did that, and I found macro a lot more enjoyable to me. So I really like it. Anyway, so let's put with talking as a macro manager. One thing that has changed, and this has changed since 2008, since the great financial crisis of 2008, is that the price of money changed. As in before, we had a, for the most part, in general terms, we had a price of money that was set freely by the market, and that price of money being interest rates. And every other price in financial markets is ultimately a function of the price of money. And if the price of money is manipulated by central banks, that means that every other price in financial markets and in everyday life is manipulated as a result, even though not directly, but indirectly, there is no longer a pricing signal that is genuine. It is a fake pricing signal. And then that becomes very complicated to try to forecast, to try to understand, because now we're going to have players doing things that they wouldn't do otherwise. Like when the price of money is very low or too low, basically the interest rates are too low, people that would save money no longer save. Now they spend it on something else because it's not worth it to save it. The effort that you need to make to save money does not get rewarded enough to do it. So people start spending money instead of saving. On the other hand, there are people that will have a project, let's say a real estate project, that would not make sense under normal conditions. But because the interest rates are low, they still do it. But it's not a project that makes sense for society under a regime of real price of money. So what it means is basically we end up wasting resources in projects that are not worth it, that only become worth it because the price of money is manipulated, and that there are people that are not saving because the price of money is manipulating, and it ultimately leads to a misallocation of resources, a misallocation of capital into projects, into businesses that are not additive to society as a whole. What this means at the end of the day is that there is little growth, economic growth, there is little creation of wealth, and this leads to disparity, wealth disparity, there unemployment, people that are underpaid, and businesses that fail, ultimately fail, because they are not worth it, because the only reason they exist is the price of money is manipulated. And now that translates into markets as well. And then we see companies that should not exist, that they exist. And what also happens is that the companies that should not exist are basically taking resources away from companies that should exist. So there is little, basically increased barrier to entry to entrepreneurs. There's less innovation. And ultimately, we get into sort of like a slow growth, while at the same time, asset prices go up because the price of money is very low. So when the dollar goes down, assets go high. When your mortgage doesn't cost you very much, you're more willing to pay for that house. So the price of the house goes higher. The same thing with stocks. When the cost of debt is low, the assets go higher. So we see this disconnect between the market and the real economy, in which the real economy is doing badly because the price of money is manipulated. And asset prices are high, houses, stocks, bonds, you name it, are high for the same reason. So they basically, with this disconnect between what we see in everyday life, what we see in the economic indicators, and what we see in the market, because that price of money has been manipulated. And I think that's what's happening right now.
Well,
if you look at...
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. And going back to, is this here to stay? When you look at Washington, when you look at the Fed, when you look at the ECB and the Bank of, like, European Central Bank, when you look at the Bank of Japan, they're all on board of keeping the interest rates at zero. Now, that means people that are going into retirement, they no longer have interest income. They cannot save into bonds. They have to take risk that they would not otherwise take. They want to inflate. They want to devalue the money, and they want to get assets higher. And they're still in that dynamic. And one day it will change, but I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Well, yeah, because they're sort of boxed in. Now, the thing that you laid out, and this is kind of an obvious question, but it when you're walking through the value of money and degrading money and manipulating the price of money, perhaps that has something to do with having a 12-year period that marks the slowest growing decade or 12-year period in the country's history, but having asset prices like the S&P up more than 350%. Would that be representative of what you were just talking about?
That is directly related.
Yeah, right.
And it's a consequence of that economic policy that is dangerous. It creates low growth because money is being wasted. And it creates an inflation in asset prices because the price of money is too low. We would be in a much better situation if the price of money was set up in a free market instead of being depressed artificially. Now, the other reason why politicians are so keen on doing this, it's because the price of money is ultimately the interest they pay on their bonds. And we have seen this in Europe many times, where we have places like Italy, Spain, Greece, that are insolvent, they will have interest rates in the 7-10+%. But if that were to happen, they will go bankrupt, right? So what the European Central Bank did is just push the rates down to such extent that it went negative. Now, so what it means is that governments are getting paid to borrow instead of paying to borrow. And in America, we have been seeing the same dynamic. We thankfully have slightly better central bank, but the idea is the same. It's like, let's put interest rates down So we don't have to pay a lot on our debt. And the people that have debt don't have to pay a lot. That's another motivation, is that they want to borrow cheap from the people.
You know, another aspect of this that I don't think that you and I have spoken about, but since I've got you here, I got into a back and forth on Twitter the other day about this. And by the way, I'll say this at the end, but by the way, for those of you out there that follow me or follow the show and the people that listen to it, follow Marcos. It's what is the Twitter handle? It's at, is it Mark Gutman? At Mark Gutman?
Mark Gutman 9.
At
9 at the end.
At Mark Gutman number 9. When you first started this, you're probably going, why is it Gutman? And I've never heard the story about how you came up with that name. But it was a pseudonym. But you have since come out of the closet and unveiled yourself on social media. So, but I wanted to get to. So I again, strongly suggest you guys follow him. That's how we actually got to meet and get to know each other. And he's got some of the best insights and observations out there, which is why we are now working together. But
don't follow me. You don't like my humor, though.
Well, I mean, I looked at that as a you know, buy one, get one free kind of thing. I mean, that was the free juice on top of it. We get the market observations, and then I get to experience some of your what I think is dry, very, very funny humor. So I'm a fan. But anyway, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, and again, I got into this conversation on Twitter, was looking at central bank activity, and the guy I was talking with made a very good point. He said, you know, we're blaming monetary policy for all this when we really should be looking at the underlying governments. The fiscal side is not carrying the water, and I think that is a very fair point, and I think it's something very solid to point out. I've also heard the Fed governors, not so much, and I've heard the people at the ECB, the European Central Bank, say the same thing, but there's always this passing of the buck to the fiscal side and to the government side. But here's my issue, and feel free to disagree. But I've looked at this and said, it seems slightly ridiculous. Now, I think they're all to blame, and I think they're all guilty for getting us in this mess, and it is a mess. But one of the things I found very ironic about central banks saying, look, we've done everything we can, the fiscal side needs to pick up their side of the deal. Well, every single time we run into a pinch, or every single time we run into a problem that is a direct result of the negligence that is being executed, or the negligent manner in which affairs are being run on the fiscal side of things, on the government side of things, the Fed then steps in and papers over it and anesthetizes or sanitizes the mistakes of the government. So I sit there and I tell them, if my attitude is if we could get the central bankers or the monetary side to leave well enough alone, it would cause some pain, but the pain would prompt the fiscal side to do what they should actually do. So I keep hearing these central bankers blaming the lack of a fiscal response, and I'm looking at them and saying, they don't need to, because you guys keep printing the money and papering over the problems and like I said, sanitizing the pain or anesthetizing the pain that should be a result of the profligate spending and the mistakes made on the fiscal side. What is your take on that? How do you line up? And do you think that I have a point there?
I think you do. I think what the central banks are doing is similar to like taking steroids. It feels good, makes you stronger in the short run, but it kills you in the long run, right?
Right.
So what? And the thing is that central banks are human, and they're there for a few years, and they don't necessarily want to get into too much trouble personally. It's much easier to give the baby a piece of candy that get the baby some broccoli, even though broccoli is better. So that's what they do. They all live in Washington. They all know each other. It's only from time to time when you have somebody like Volcker with very principled and sort of like a man with his own beliefs that can do something. And the situation back in the day in the 80s when inflation was sort of like north of 10%, it was critical, so he got people on board. But right now, there is no impetus, really. Don't forget that it's Congress who appoints the chairman of the Fed. So they have some say who, what type of person goes into the Fed. Even though the Fed is independent, they're still being appointed by Congress. So there is a bit of dependency there. And it's always easier to give candy to the baby than give it a piece of broccoli when you know that you're leaving the house at the end of the day because you're basically the babysitter. So that's what happens. I think there's a bit of moral hazard there. On the fiscal side, a lot is being said about the fiscal side, so basically government spending, right? I have my doubts about that because the governments in general, no matter which ones, they don't really have a very good track record of being efficient with people's money. They're spending very easily, and they don't always use it in a wise way. I have my thoughts about what would be the best way to go ahead. I think I'm being idealistic in what I want. I think regulations should be easier. It should be easier to start up a business. It should be less protection of the big business. It should be less barriers to entry. It should be easier to do things your own way. Take a risk as a person and do the American dream. It's just work hard, add value to your clients, and you will be fine.
The
problem is that because of the financial model is manipulated, the incumbents have huge leverage over the newcomers. So there's no newcomers are coming in. Try setting up a business today. You're against the big guys because the big guys have all the power in terms of access to the cheap money that the new guy doesn't have. So they have an unfair advantage because the price of money is too cheap. So no entrepreneurs can really set up a business. And if they do, it's very hard to grow. That means that people that would otherwise set up a business, they are now employees of a big business. There are more and more concentration of big business. That means that when you are looking for a job, you don't have that many places to choose from. So that means that your wage is overly low because the price of money is too low. Because then that concentrated the power in the big companies. And that is the source of a lot of our problems. So we need higher price of money, even though it's painful at the beginning. That will level the playing field a lot more. And we need to get lobbies out of Washington and stop protecting the big business and let the small guy grow and set up a business and be productive in a way that they are not today. But I mean, that is going to be impossible to do anyway.
I was going to say we need to have you running for president. We just need to try to get around that whole Spanish born situation, and then we're going to be good to go. The other thing too that guys like you and I again have spent. I mean, you look at the amount of government debt that has been racked up. You know, and I sit there and again. You're never going to hear the FOMC or the European Central Bank. You're never going to hear these guys take the blame for it, of course. And I sat there just gobsmacked when I heard Powell in a recent interview say that the Fed has nothing to do with the wealth inequality here in the United States. And I just kind of fell off my chair. But, you know, another big problem that we face, and that problem has become much more acute this year, and will only increase, becoming increasingly more acute over the next 10 years or so. It's the same similar problem that we see with governments the world over, which is they've levered up and they've amassed debts that are virtually unpayable. And one of the questions I have when I look at the structure of central banks and the roles they're playing in markets is, had the central banks not been playing this price of money fixing for the last 40 years, it really is almost impossible for the governments to have amassed that much debt. Wouldn't you agree, again, with your macro hat on, that the central bank's control of the price of money is a direct correlation to the amount of debt that governments have racked up?
let me answer that question with another question. When the price of something is low, do you buy more or less than when the price is high?
Yeah, you buy more.
You buy more. So that's exactly what governments did. Because the cost of debt, basically the interest rates, is too low, they bought more of it. And they've done this in Europe. They've done that in the States. They've done that in Japan. And they go hand in hand. When the interest rates are artificially low, the governments will take on more debt. Because for the same payment, they will get on more money up front. So obviously they're going to do that day and night. It is absolutely related. It is the same thing. One goes with the other.
Now, again, with your the macro hat still on, this is going to be kind of a merger here. Wanted to ask you some questions about value and money. Last week, value investing, and then as it relates to an intersection with monetary policy. And believe me, it seems ambitious, but I will tie this together. Last week on the show, I teased a segment. We have an interview with Luke Grohman coming up here in the next week or two. We're still trying to work out the details of that. And I wanted to discuss some finite points about currencies and currency valuations with him. And one of the things that I was thinking about and have spent a significant amount of time thinking about is that we're looking at currency valuations. A lot of people out there are dollar bears. I certainly understand the sentiment behind it. Yet a lot of people that are dollar bulls. I mean, I think long term you have to be bearish on the dollar. Maybe there's people that aren't, but long term it seems kind of like a foregone conclusion to me. But one of the things that I was thinking about is when every government around the world is doing the exact same thing, which is suppressing the price of money, racking up amounts, unpayable debts, juicing the economy at every given turn, issuing stimulus. When they're all doing the same, what is the real difference between currencies? And is it possible, at least theoretically? And it was also interesting to me, too, to watch an environment like you had in March and in February, where the dollar should have blown the top off the market. And it did. It got rather high. It was at 20-year highs. But from my perspective looking at it, it was the swap lines that they had set up. There were 16 swap lines they've got set up. And you could almost feel those swap lines burning up. They were engaged in it. We saw the numbers. We've seen the proof afterwards. So we know that there were significant amount of fund flows in the form of swaps going on. What is the world of currencies going to look like going forward? Because what do currency valuations mean anymore? I mean, it's almost like we're comparing, it's almost like kids trading baseball cards, right? Meaning that no currency out there is backed any longer. It's all fiat currency. And one of the things I started thinking about is in that light, especially with the establishment of swap lines, in the financial crisis, the Fed had 8 swap lines established with other central banks. By the time this one rolled around, there were 16. One of the things I started thinking about is it possible for a big chunk or the majority or maybe all of the major currencies around the world to eventually trade at parity? And if so, and if the Fed is using the swap lines in such a way to repress the price of the dollar, do we already have a one world currency? Is that and it's kind of a nuanced question, and it sounds insane. There's probably a lot of macro people that are going to listen to this and go, what are you talking about, trading at parity? But what I'm saying is that it's the artificial printing and the injections of artificial stimulus that are keeping all these economies going. When their currency falls under pressure, the Fed, with their unlimited ability to print more dollars, just burns up the swap lines. Do we already have a one world currency? And is it possible that eventually currencies could just trade at parity and it would be essentially a one world currency?
When you say trading at parity, what do you mean?
Well, I'm just saying, like, if you look at the different spreads, the different valuations of the currency, and obviously it matters which currency we're measuring them. But if we were measuring currencies in the dollar, could we eventually just see all these currencies converging? Right. So maybe the spread, I mean, the euro and the dollar got down to what? I mean, the euro was trading at 110 I think on the bottom, maybe you got it slightly lower than that. I mean, because they're all doing exactly the same thing, right? So what is determining the value of currencies? It's certainly not the balance sheets of the underlying governments any longer. You look at the United States, it was probably the strongest currency that I'm aware of that in terms of how it held up during this latest hit. I mean, it surged. A lot of other currencies were getting hit. But then you look at the United States government's balance sheet and you look at the unfunded liabilities out there, and they're worse than everybody else's. What is determining currency valuations? And is it just semantics at this point?
No, it's not semantics. On the trading at party, I don't think it is, because I don't think it will be the case, because the numbers that we put on currencies are completely artificial. We could give them a different number and it will still be the same. Like we could measure the British pounds and British pence.
That's true. Yeah.
Put them together in five. I mean, the actual number doesn't mean anything. What set of the currency values? It is a complex question. There are a lot of moving pieces. When we set up the value of a currency, let's say the pound versus the dollar, there are two legs. There is a pound and there is a dollar. So it's just always a relative valuation. There is not an absolute value. Like you could say, my house is this many dollars. The pound is this many dollars, but the exchange rate between the two is actually have two moving parts. One is the dollar and the pound, or the dollar and the euro, the dollar and the yen. So it is always a relative game. The ultimate driver of currencies in the very long run is the relative productivity of each of the economies. An economy that is very productive, that creates a lot of wealth, that creates growth, will see its currency appreciate in value, and the opposite. An economy that is not productive, that is not growing, that is not creating wealth, will depreciate in value. And that's why the pound, pre-World War II, it was the premier currency. And after the World War II, it's been the dollar. Because the dollar, linked to the economy of the United States, it's been the strongest, the most dynamic, the most wealth creator, and that's why it becomes the reserve currency and the one that everybody wants to own and ultimately the stronger. Now that's in the very long run. In the short term, it is more related to flows, like how much demand there is for this currency versus this other currency on a day-to-day basis. There in that bucket will be sort of like the trade flows, right? When I, let's say, Germany sell a lot of cars to America, Americans will send money to Germany to buy the cars, and the value of the euro will go up because a lot of merchandise is leaving Germany and a lot of money is coming into Germany. That will push the price of the euro up relative to the dollar. So in the short term, we have that. And then we have the other big leg, which is investment flows. Let's say I'm a German and I got euros because I sold my Mercedes to an American, but I like the house in Florida, so I'm going to go buy a house in Florida because I like living in America. So that will send money back to America, and that also pushes the dollar up versus the euro. So there's a lot of moving pieces. So those are the economic players. And then there's the uneconomic players, like the central banks, that will print money at certain amounts. And if they print money at the same rate that the economy is growing, the value of the currency will remain constant. If they print money at a rate that is higher than the growth of the economy, there will be excess currency and the currency will go down in value. And those are players that are not economically rational, like the guy buying a German car or the German guy buying a house in Florida. They do it independently. They do it rationally to them. Central banks have ulterior motives that is not them. They have political motives. They have other goals that are not necessarily economically rational. for why they do things. And we're seeing that now at an increasing pace where, and they do it sometimes to increase the productivity of their own economies in the short term. Let's say that you are, just for argument's sake, we are Canada and we want to sell more of our Canadian things to Americans. It will help if our currency was cheap. So our widgets will be cheap to Americans, for Americans to buy. So they will send us more of their dollars to us to buy our widgets. So what we're going to do is going to print a lot of Canadian dollars. The Canadian dollar is going to weaken, and we're going to suck demand out of America into our own economy. And that will hurt, in relative terms, that will hurt American companies, and that will benefit Canadian companies. So now there is a lot of that going on these days, because it is sort of like a trade war behind the scenes, in which we print money, we want our currency to weaken, so we steal business from other countries. And that is happening across the board, on top of the motivations on keeping the price of money too low, keeping the cost of debt too low. There is that going on. That makes the game very, very difficult, because it's no longer about understanding the real economic flows as to what cars goes where and what house get bought. It's about non-economic players with agendas that we cannot really understand unless we're in the room with them.
Right.
And it is really a black box. And that has made the life of currency traders and companies that depend on currency flows very, very complicated, because it's very difficult to plan around that. And it's also very difficult to know who is going to be more enthusiastic about this creation of money, because that will set up the relative value of one currency versus the other, right? It's like the Americans will see the Canadians devaluing their own currency, and they will say, we're going to do the same, so we can steal business out of Canada. So depending on who is more enthusiastic in that process will determine the exchange rate between Canadian dollar and the US dollar. And that is really a black box. The only way we can see that is through the market, seeing how the currencies are moving, because nobody is really announcing, hey, guys, I'm going to print the money. Because then the other guy will do the same. They just do it without telling anybody, including you and I. So that is complicated. The only way to figure that out is through the market. And ultimately, what this is creating is what is called a race to the bottom. It's like, who is going to print the most? Who is going to cheapen the currency most? And that has direct implications to asset prices. Obviously, when the value of the currency goes down, the value of assets, let's say a house in that currency, goes up, because when $100,000 will buy you a house, now the same house will require $200,000, because the dollar just went down by half. So the house looks like it went up by double, but it's not the dollar. The dollar went down by half. So that's, I think, is part of what we're seeing in the gold market. That's why part of what we're seeing in the stock market. And that we're seeing in the real estate market, where assets keep going up in nominal terms. But what is really happening is that the value of the money in our pockets is going down.
Yeah, it certainly is. Now, as it relates to the rest of the broader market, you and I have talked about this at great length offline, but I want people to hear it from your perspective. Do you think we're looking at a market here that makes sense? There's a lot of people trying to, and you're going to hear a whole litany of different opinions on it and different takes on it. There's people that say the market's pricing in an economic recovery. There's other people that say this market is purely being driven by printed money and governments running up deficits. There's other people that will argue still that the market is overvalued on a fundamental basis, but it is responding to that money printing. Then there's other people that act like that this whole issue that we faced was merely a 6 to 8 month bump in the road, and that everything should be back on level within, 8 to 12 months, and the market is just pricing that in. It's no big deal. What are we looking at? Because it's not just me. You know, we talk to a lot of retail investors. We also talk to a lot of institutional investors. And there's a lot of people out there scratching their head right now saying the strength of this market in the face of what we are currently seeing doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I know that we've spent time talking about how markets don't make sense for periods of time, which is what, you know, was really the impetus behind you launching the algorithm. But what are we looking at here market wise? We're looking at here in the US, being US focused, we're looking at a market that is setting records in valuations, NASDAQ hitting new all time highs, S&P breathing, you know, virtually at a new all time high, just brushing up against it. And we're looking at an underlying economy that's had a massive hole the size of a Volkswagen blown in the side of it. How do we explain this? How are you rationalizing this at this point? Do you think this is a dislocation? Do you think that we're just responding to printed money? Do you think this is a mania? Where are we at? And where do you think we're headed? It's not a very loaded question, is it?
No, it's a fair question, to be honest.
Yeah.
because we are all asking the same questions.
Right.
Like, if we look at the market the way the market used to be, we come to that conclusion. If we look at the market from the perspective of the new reality, it does make sense. As is the case with currencies, stock prices are a relative game. It's a relative game versus what other things you can do with the money. The money that is being printed at an increasing rate. Now, what would you rather own? Would you rather own Microsoft at a, I don't know, what was the, like 2.5% dividend yield?
No way.
Would you rather own a 30%, a 30-year bond at 1% yield?
Well, let me run some discounted cash flow models and I'll get back to you. it's a fair point.
You own a solid company like Microsoft that has no debt, that is paying a regular dividend, that is not a lot, it's not massive, but it's pretty guaranteed. It's run well, has longevity. Would you rather own Microsoft or would you rather own a 10-year bond that pays you 0.6? I think most people go for Microsoft. So from that perspective of a relative game, what do I do with my dollars? I'm retired. I don't know where to put my money, my savings. If I put it with the U.S. government, I get almost nothing. If I put it with Microsoft, I get something.
Now, I mean, Argentina was paying 7%.
There are other things there involved, but
yeah, no,
that's why I picked Microsoft, right? But
yeah,
but that is the question that a lot of investors are asking themselves. And at the end of the day, it is a really hard, it's a difficult decision, right? If you look at it from the old school perspective, if you look at it from the perspective of, okay, the price of money is being manipulated, so if I buy a bond, I get paid nothing, but if I buy a stock, I get paid something. That's how a lot of people are thinking about it. It is easy to forget that you have more risk owning a stock. But that's sort of like a problem for tomorrow because I need to pay my bills today.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening. And that is going full circle about the problem with manipulating the money. There is a tremendous amount of risk as a result, right?
Right.
There's a tremendous amount of risk because people are paying elevated prices for assets that should be trading lower under normal conditions. So people are overpaying for assets because they have no choice, because they are financially repressed. They are literally painted into a corner and force-fed. They've been obligated to make decisions that they would not otherwise make. But the risk is still there. It's just that we have no choice but to take it. And that's a problem. Now, this doesn't mean that the stock market is going to crash Because as long as people are being corralled into this choice of getting paid nothing or getting paid something, they're always going to take the getting paid something because they need to. Because we all need to pay our bills. We all need to pay schools, cars, houses, clothing. We need to get regular income. So that's not coming from the bonds anymore on purpose. So we have to go looking for other avenues to get it. So people are really being corralled, reinforced to buy these things that they don't like doing, but they have no choice. So that is, it is risky, but they can also send prices 2x, 3x from where we are now, because when we disconnect from rational decisions, there is no telling when it stops. When something gets crazy, it can get double crazy and still be crazy.
Well, you bring up a really interesting point, because this is, without a question, one of our, and we'd been looking for this for about 2.5 to 3 years, because I am of the belief, and when you say this, I will excite some people on one side, I will tick some people off on the other side, and that usually tells me that I'm onto something. I really know I'm onto something when people on both sides of the argument are mad at me. That's how I know I'm in the sweet spot. But one of the things, watching these markets over the last 10, 12 years, that we came to a conclusion of here internally was, and again, that search started in earnest about 3.5 years ago, that we, for all the reasons that you and I have discussed, for the reasons that you just laid out, why I thought it was so important to have a portion of our portfolio algorithmically or systematically driven, because it takes that human element out of it. Now, I think the human element, if done correctly and done by a prudent and talented and knowledgeable investor, I think that that's a valuable part of the equation. But it also, to me, underlies the need in this marketplace and in this new world, as you put it, to have a systematic and algorithmic approach, because like I said, it just adopts, right? The algorithm doesn't know whether the market's going to crash. It's not reading underlying valuations. It's not. It's just looking at our things going up and down. Is that a fair description of why you wanted to develop an algorithmic strategy? Was because of this market environment? Did that have a lot to do with it? What got you to the point from being a macro guy who previously was focused on value to really take that plunge? Is it something you thought about for a really long time and that you knew there was a necessity for? Was it more of an adaptation that came about naturally, just as a product of this environment?
It is a combination of things. It is a combination of my quantitative background but I got really got the urge during this period of quote unquote incomprehensible markets that I had to change my approach, and I became more aware of my own cognitive biases, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it is very difficult for a person to change opinion, right?
Yeah.
That's why a lot of these discretionary managers have had so much trouble adapting to the new market, myself included. But I sort of came to the realization that I had to change my ways because the market had changed. And I had to overcome my own cognitive biases and my own weaknesses as a portfolio manager. And I was aware, because of my professional experience, that the best way to do that is to create a process, create a systematic, rule-based investment process that takes away opinions, that takes away cognitive biases, and that invest in a market the way the market is, not the way the market is, the way you want it. According to my opinion.
Yeah.
Right? So the algo does not care about the Fed, does not care about valuations, does not care about anything other than supply demand for my stocks and risk management. Because as we were saying, the risk is pretty high. So now you need extra risk management. You cannot have a passive approach to the market because the risks are very high. I do believe you need an active risk management approach that selects the stocks that are going up. I think the market as a whole is really dangerous. That does not mean that there are specific pockets in the market that offer opportunity. And this is what we do. But ultimately, it came down to the market has changed. I have to change with the market. I need to figure out. I need to find the way I can make money in this market. And to make a long story short, that's what the algo was. It was a new way of trading the market that is completely non-emotional, completely focused on pricing and making money and not losing money, as opposed to my own opinion about how the world should work. It doesn't care about how the world should work. It only cares about how the world works right now. And maybe in a year's time, it works differently and it will not care. It will not have baggage.
In a lot of ways, it sounds like a soulless capitalist, right?
this algo is completely ruthless. It doesn't care about anything other than the capital. It doesn't care about Zach. It doesn't care about me. It doesn't care about anybody. It only cares about the money, the capital and protecting it.
Well, and we saw that. That was what was fascinating to me, is that some of those stocks that it found that were related to companies that do well in coronavirus, the algorithm doesn't know what coronavirus is. It had no clue what coronavirus was due to the, and yet through the systematic approach, it found the things that worked well in a coronavirus environment. That was sort of the lights on moment for me, where I just kind of sat back in my chair and went, isn't that funny? And you put it, and if I botch this, you'll have to forgive me, but you put it in a way that just made perfect sense, which you said, Zach, you're not paying attention to all the information in the price. That the pricing of these assets and the direction they're moving, there's a lot of information in there, right?
Everything is in there at the end of the day. Otherwise, the price would not be there.
Now, how do we explain these companies like Tesla then? Right. What information is into that price of that stock? Now, for you, for those of you that don't know, that are listening, which I'm assuming most of you don't, unless you're on Twitter, Marcos hates it when I drag him into the Tesla conversation because neither of us have a position in it. Okay. We don't have a position firm wide, but it's just a question I got to ask you.
Look, if we go to the very first thing I said, is that share prices are set by supply or demand of shares. Tesla happens to be a stock that does not have a lot of supply of stock, because most of it is privately owned. What is traded on the market is just but a very small part of all the shares that are out there. That means that there's very few shares that can be bought by the public at large. Now, we have in Tesla a good story, and we have a master storyteller at the head of Tesla that has infatuated a lot of young people for the most part, that is telling fantastic stories that people are buying into. What that means is that there is a lot of demand for shares of Tesla. And like in every market, the price is set by the highest bidder. So the bidder that is most motivated, the bidder that buys the story the most, will pay the most. And that's how we set up the value of Tesla. That's nothing to do with the quote-unquote fundamentals, or how much money Tesla makes or doesn't make, or how much debt it has or doesn't have, because that's not how stocks really work in reality. It's not how it works. What it works is that if somebody loves it and is willing to pay a high price, the price will be high. It'll be until there is only a handful of people that are willing to pay that price, because there are only very few shares that are available to trade. That's what's happening. It has nothing to do with Tesla itself as a company. It has everything to do with Tesla itself as a stock, which we need to make a difference. And that's a good example of something that we were saying before. That is, there's once something disconnects from the economic reality, there is no telling where it will go. And this is the market today. The market today is like Tesla. It is disconnected from the economic reality. People are buying the market for reasons other than the economic reality, like people are buying Tesla. And once we have that disconnect, there are no limits. It can really get crazy square. And there is no reason why other than it's just crazy. I mean, it sounds, it's maybe not a best explanation of it, but it's
no.
It is how it is. Once you go down to players that are not making their decisions from an economic rationality, where it becomes irrational, there's just no, it is unbounded. There is no longer a rebalancing mechanism. In a regular market, when prices get too high, somebody will do something to either increase supply or stop buying, and prices will automatically rebalance. The market will act, a market that is rational from an economic perspective will rebalance and bring prices down. Like oil is a good example. When oil is expensive, people buy less, and Exxon and Chevron will produce more, and the prices will go down. And that is a very well understood mechanism when things are rational. When things become irrational for whatever reason, like people, we were commenting, people buying stocks because they have no other choice, or people buying Tesla because they love the story, because they feel good themselves owning a share of Tesla. It has nothing to do with economics. It has to do with things that are not economics. It becomes irrational. Then it's unbounded. There's no bounds. There is no rebalancing mechanism. There is no breaking point. It just can go on and on and on.
Yeah, it becomes somewhat of a popularity contest at that point. Well, go ahead.
No, nothing. That's that is why I think the market could potentially go much, much higher than it is right now, even though it's hard to believe. The same way that Tesla, when right now is trading around 1500, when Tesla was trading 500, he was absolutely crazy. It didn't make sense. It didn't make sense at 200.
Yeah.
Now we are 10 times higher. There is no stopping there. There's no reason. Rhyme or reason.
But that being said, you know, again, history tells us that then it can run into a brick wall at any time, because like you've pointed out, there is no underlying rational reason. There is no rational underlying support. So and that's the tough part about playing these, right? They can continue to go up and then they can end just as quick, right? They can just dissipate.
That's why the risk is high, and that's why the algorithmic approach that does not concern itself with the rationality of players. It just observes the players play the game and plays with them. It does not tell the players what they should be doing. It just plays the game as it's being played, not as it was played before.
Yeah.
That's why when it goes to coronavirus, it doesn't know that the coronavirus exists, but it can see that there is something that is putting demand into that stock. So it's going to go there. It doesn't know that it's coronavirus. It just only sees the numbers.
Well,
and it doesn't make a judgment out as to whether it is right or not.
Right. It's cold, hard logic and reason, or not even logic, just responding to the...
It's completely unemotional about it.
Right.
It doesn't say this is wrong, right or wrong. It's just, this is what it is. And when it comes to making money and risk management, when it comes to that, that's the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
The market does not think about what is right. The market as a whole does not care about what is right or wrong. It only cares about the flows.
And we've spent unimaginable time working on and thinking about and discussing keeping emotions out of the game. But, maybe there's somebody out there, but I tend to think not, that it's virtually impossible, right? The emotions leak in at some point, and unfortunately, they almost always lead us in the wrong place. And
isn't that the fundamental of the value approach?
Yes. Yes, it is.
That market gets depressed in the same way that they get overly enthusiastic. It gets overly depressed.
Right. And the question is...
And that's when you come in as a value investor, because the market is being emotional about something. And then over time, you will recognize the true value. But without irrationality, without emotion, there will be no value.
Well, and this is a theoretical...
This
is a theoretical argument, and it's one that I've thought a lot about too, is bringing up the whole aspect of, you know, wanting to be true to the value approach, but then also realizing that if you look at great value investors like Buffett, who I certainly admire as far as his success and his track record goes, he has the ability to sit back and make subpar returns for a decade, and he will stick to his approach. When you're managing people's retirement money, we don't have time. We don't have the luxury to wait. We cannot afford a bad decade, because on average, the average retirement lasts something like 22 years, right? That's 50% of your retirement time. And, where Buffett is going to stick to his guns as long as he's alive. But then I remind myself, but he's worth $45 billion. Right. He's not going to pivot away from what's made him $45 billion, nor would I expect him to. But it also does not mean that that alone is enough to get the job done in retirement. We've got to have different approaches that hedge, right, the hedge that possibility that strict value approach is not going to work for a decade, because, like I said, in retirement, we can't waste a decade. That's 50% of our retirement.
Yes. Most people, or people that are not Warren Buffett, cannot wait that long. I think it can be argued that he can't either right now.
Right. Yeah.
The problem with a long-term approach is that even though it makes money, you are subject to the moods of the market for long periods of time. As you said, it can be 10 years. You can lose 50% of your money in the meantime, even though you may come out whole at the other end, but in the meantime, you were down maybe 50%. That's not acceptable for most people, and it's not acceptable to me, at least. That's why our approach is very dynamic. It is very quick at getting out of the market when conditions deteriorate. When it's stormy, when it's bad weather, when the conditions are bad, we retreat. We put the money in cash and we wait for sunny weather, and we go out again when the sun is shining. That also means that we're going to miss the bottom, because we're not going to be invested at the bottom. We're not going to be invested on the way down. That means that at the bottom, we will not be invested. So we will miss it. But that is the trade-off that I'm willing to take to not lose money.
Well,
if I lose the money on the way down, then I have to work a lot harder on the way up.
It's also the reason that you're sitting on a decent gain this year, my friend. So, and it's benefited me, and it's benefited our clients. So I'm okay missing out on the bottom, especially when I'm sitting there at the bottom looking at an account that's down 7 when the market's down 36. So that's a trade-off that I'll take every time. Right?
Yes, and the emotional aspect of seeing 35% of your money gone is the one that makes you take bad decisions at the bottom. A lot of people will say, I bought the bottom, but that's hard to believe. Most people will sell the bottom. That's what creates the bottom. It's very easy to look at a chart and say, oh, during this period, it was down 35%, but if you held, it will be okay. The reality of life is that you probably didn't hold. Because when you see a third of your money go up and disappear, that's the moment where most people will panic and sell.
Yeah. And that's where you get your washouts and your washouts exactly. and your capitulation bottoms, right?
We don't even want to be in that situation, so we keep a cool head all the time, and we want your clients to be able to have that peace of mind that they don't have to make decisions that are suboptimal because they're being driven by strong emotions that are completely understandable, completely rational, because when things are going down the drain, is the rational thing to do is to get out.
Well, and
which is what we do at the same time. But it's like, but we have this philosophy is that if you go into panic, panic first.
Yeah.
Last. It's like we are very, very conservative with the risk management. And the moment something is not working, we get out because we rather panic now than later.
Yeah, panic with a profit rather than a loss, right?
Yeah, panic first. If you go into panic, panic first. So it is, to some extent, that's what the risk management ultimately means.
Well, and I think that's a good point to wrap it up. But I will also say that for those of you out there that have panicked, one of the reasons was, or the reason was, right, is because you weren't properly managing your risk. And when, you know, for our clients, Marcos, so you were there through it, we didn't, you know, and I realize that most investors know that, you know, try to avoid that, especially these days, even in the retail, knowing that we can't puke all of our stocks out at the bottom. If we're down, we got to take it and we got to get through it. But one of the ways to prevent that, we did not have a single client call panicked, asking us to sell out. Now, a lot of that was because when the market was down 36, they were down about 6.5 on average. That really how, right? People go, well, that's good that you stay disciplined. Well, part of being disciplined and part of being able to stick it out and not puke there at the bottom is if you're not down a lot, like you said, panic at the highs. Now, if people want to get a hold of you, again, I brought up, they can follow you at Mark Gutman, GUTMAN9 on Twitter. And Marco's firm who we've partnered with is Ascent Advisors. I should have this. I don't have it right in front of me right now, but what is the website they can go visit the,
Yeah, so the website is ascentsystematic.com.
And if you guys want more information on us, you've heard me talk about the Momentum Portfolio. You can also call us and access more information on the Momentum Portfolio through us. But it is something that we are committed. I think Marcos is as smart and talented as they come, and we're thrilled to be partnered with him. And Marcos, I can't thank you enough for finally coming on and getting you on here. And hopefully we'll be able to get you on in not too distant future to discuss more crazy market gyrations and what's to come, because although we don't have an idea, it's probably going to be pretty exciting, huh?
I think so. And I want to thank you, Zach, for having me. I hope it's been useful. It's been really enjoyable to me. If you have anything, you know where to find me.
You bet I do. All right, you guys. Well, that wraps up the interview. Thank you so much for joining us. And stay tuned. Keep looking out for these interviews, because we got a couple big ones on the docket coming up over the next couple weeks. And as always, we will see you next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH and Cairo 97.3 FM.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.